morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And be prepared, because today we're bringing one Lulu of a boozy program.
We are. We are indeed. But we have a surprise ending.
We
so
do.
There. Just for the hell of it, we have a surprise ending. But starting out, here's a thought. How many of you loyal listeners of On the Menu are also wine lovers? And the job you know you'd love to have is you'd love to own a wine shop or a wine bar or something like that. Wouldn't that be the fulfillment of all your dreams? Well, Marco Passanella, living in New York City with a totally different profession. I think, wasn't he an architect or something like that?
Yes.
And he decided to do something totally crazy and instead buy a building next to the Fulton Fish Market, open a wine shop, and the rest is history, as they say. But it turns out it's quite a long story with some unusual
twists and turns,
shall we say. So here's Marco Passanella, who wrote it all down for you so that you couldn't possibly make the same mistake yourself. And the book's called Uncorked, and you will be when you're done listening to Marco. Marco Passanella, welcome to On the Menu Radio. We're delighted to have you as our guest today.
Well, thank you, Peter and Anne. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, the approximate reason for you to be joining us today is that you just recently published a book that's sort of like a life story. It's sort of like a number of other things. But the title, Uncorked, listeners, will give you an idea that there's perhaps some craziness in here, too.
Now, look at the picture.
And so before we began the interview on the air, I asked Marco, I said, tell me what this book is supposed to be. Is it supposed to be a book that teaches you about wine? Is it supposed to be a recipe book?
Because there are recipes.
Or is it supposed to be a book that simply describes the life you've had and in the event that people might be interested? So which is it? Maybe it's all of them.
Well, I think it's partly about the discovery of wine. I cannot say that even after 6 years that I'm nearly an expert. But I think one learns about wine as I learn about it in the book. I think also it's partly about, frankly, a midlife crisis. Well, maybe not so much a midlife crisis as a midlife malaise of having a perfectly good life, but feeling like something was missing.
That
maybe
you were really an accomplished designer.
I was doing fine. I was doing great. And I wasn't suffering, and I just sort of had a more kind of existential kind of crisis, just saying, as the Peggy Lee song goes, is that all there is?
Uh-huh.
So then you decided to do something completely insane.
Yeah, and throw my marriage and my finances into total tumult.
Now, why did you can explain the insanity part possibly quicker than I can.
Well, part of the insanity is I had never been in the wine business. I had just bought a building, which the wine store occupies the first floor of, in the Fulton Fish Market down in Lower Manhattan in New York City. So I was really, it was a baptism by fire. First, that I was in the middle of the fish market with a fishmonger as my tenant, with 75,000 pounds of salmon coming in and out of my front door every day. And then once the fish market relocated to the Bronx to undertake opening up a wine store was another, either a leap of faith or just a total crazy.
You also chose to live there.
And we also chose to live there, yes. So we were renovating and dealing with the fish market and then opening up this new business. And my wife was pregnant.
So, how many years did it take for the smell of dead fish to really go away?
Well, there are some in the neighborhood who say it still hasn't gone away. But I think that actually went, at least friends of ours to whom we went to dinner no longer commented on our coats. The inside of the store went relatively quickly, but for 150 years they had sold the fish on the street, closing down the South Street, which is the
main
street.
Oh, yeah, I remember the old market.
Along the water every night. So there were a lot of cracks and crevices in South Street, and I would say it was a good 3 or 4 years before you really felt like the smell had completely gone away.
And besides, it wasn't really a place people went, was it? I mean, unless you were buying fish, you sort of didn't go there. It seems, I think your friends told you, it seems like a very strange neighborhood in which to open a wine store.
Yeah, that's a very old neighborhood.
Yes. On the one hand, it was an incredibly old neighborhood that had been kind of overlooked. It had been so much unto itself that even most New Yorkers like myself really hadn't, I didn't know the neighborhood really until we moved here. Having said that, as we moved here, it was also at the same time as the contiguous neighborhood of downtown Manhattan was undergoing a huge renaissance, and lots of the old office buildings were being converted to apartments. So the neighborhood was exploding 13 times faster than the rest of Manhattan, and it was a good sign for us.
So that gave you a lot of customers who wouldn't have been there perhaps 10 years before.
Exactly.
Now,
exactly.
So you said, okay, I'm going to open a wine shop. Now, we'll put that piece of craziness behind us. But at that time, you were basically a home and restaurant wine consumer.
Exactly.
You did
on the other side.
Okay. So you could see from a customer's point of view, but you had much difficulty, I guess, in trying to figure out what to buy unless you bought everything.
Exactly. Well, I think that one of the first things I did was hire a wine director who knew her stuff.
Oh, Janet, this is.
Yes. She turned out to be a lot to handle, but
yes,
she certainly did know her wine.
Well, you know, I think that this, we ought to mention that you have a parade of these characters through the book, which really adds a whole other dimension to the story.
Yeah, you can't wait to figure out what dumb thing they're going to do next.
Well, you know, the wine world attracts people with very strong personalities, whether it's the producers who, you know, frankly, there are a lot of easier ways to make a living, and you really have to be taken by your profession to be a producer. There are 25,000 producers represented in New York City. That's a lot of choice and makes for some people that really are driven, as well as the importers themselves who have these kind of impresario reputations of tastemakers and so forth, that you end up getting a lot of characters in wine.
I wanted to ask you about a couple of things. There are so many things one could ask about, but I think you learned about two things in particular that I think are illustrative to someone who might be thinking about getting into business, but also just to somebody who's actually going to go to a wine shop and try to understand how it works.
Right.
One is that you thought that one way you could get to a magic price point, and the magic price point being somewhere between $10 and $15, your selling price in the store.
Right.
And one of the ways you got there was to say, I'm going to buy wine in bulk myself in Italy and other places, but especially in Italy, and I'm going to be responsible for it. I'm going to bottle it. I'm going to import it.
Yes.
And now I believe you've even gone more extreme than that and decided you're actually going to make it as well.
Yes.
So that's one thing. And then the other thing is the middle part of the three-tier distribution system, the power that exists in the distributors, and especially the particularly strong and arrogant ones like Southern Wines and Spirits. So pick which one you'd like to talk about first, and then the other one.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I guess the first one in terms of the prices of wine, I mean, you know, there really is so much choice. Between $10 and $15, the world opens up, and we wanted our customers to be able to discover some of that world that exists in a kind of an everyday wine. So I think that was always part of our mission, is to allow them to see what the possibilities are in something that's pretty reasonably priced, and you wouldn't have to be stretch your budget, and you could just feel like, oh, you know what, I'm going to just take a chance on that discovery. So yeah, no, that was, I think that's always been a point of ours, is to try that to provide reasonably priced, great discoveries for our customers.
But you found out that there were some real adventures in being responsible for whole containers of wine.
Bringing it in ourselves, we realized why distributors are so valued. Because it's a big pain to do it yourself, but there are lots of potential pitfalls along the way.
But at the same time, you said that there are not only strong players who like to throw their weight around, but there's also competition, and not necessarily a very savory competition, between everyone who's coming to call on you trying to get you to buy their wines.
Well, yeah, there is a lot of wine in the world. I mean, it's a great thing for consumers to know, but it can make the competition for those wineries cutthroat.
There are some names, I guess they're mostly distributors or importers, that really seem to me, I mean, for example, Kermit Lynch has an extremely fine reputation.
Yes.
So if you're looking at a wine in your shop, and it's, or anybody else's shop for that matter, and it's imported by Kermit Lynch, then you can probably figure out that it's pretty good wine.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the kind of the tricks of the trade is actually to, when you go to a wine shop, to turn the bottle around and look at the back.
Do you have some others that you really like?
Some other importers?
Some other names like that, yes.
Oh, I Neil Rosenthal is one of the ones in New York that was just terrific. Michael Skernick is a terrific one. Wygant Selections are another. You know, there are a handful that really are amongst the premier importers and of wine in the United States. But Kermit Lynch is definitely one of my favorites.
You go on then and you talk about stocking your store with wines and going much more upmarket.
Yes.
And saying, you know, I want to be able to offer Brunellos and Barolos and heavyweights of this kind. That must have been kind of a different experience.
Yeah, I think that we still, as I think that we, I'm a Target shopper, but you could also every once in a while find me splurge at Prada. There are the same person, maybe every day, is very conscious about not spending a whole lot on an everyday wine, but would want something for a special occasion or to bring something to dinner, and we felt that we had to start addressing that person, too, on that special occasion.
Now, you've got lots and lots of tips. We can't even go over, you know, the five-point biggest, is it?
Misconceptions about wine.
You have a whole lot of...
There's some things here I didn't know at all, by the way.
These are all, listeners, these are all in appendixes, so you have to, if you want them, you have to, smart to go to the end.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Anne, what did
you... No, I can't remember what it is now, but there were some of these tips in the appendix that actually were new to me after all the wine tasting I've done, and still new to me.
Oh, wow.
And, but I also enjoyed your 10 strangest words in wine, because I used to collapse at these wine tastings. We used to do these blind tastings with a group of people. You talk about characters.
Yeah. Well, there is this whole language. One of the things I discovered is there's this whole language in describing wine. It's hard to describe a taste, but there seems to be a kind of a meta language that has where you see these words bandied about, and you go, I guess you guys are all nodding, but I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Like cat's piss and dirty socks.
Or it's oriental saddle leather. Well, actually, I've never really smelled oriental saddle leather, so I couldn't really tell you. But I think it's all, we try to help our customers try to understand what something tastes like. And often, I think what's interesting is sometimes the more metaphoric, the better, which is to say we had, for example, I don't know, the absolute classic Sancerre. And yes, in the store, one of the things that's been surprising is sometimes how the most literal descriptors are not necessarily the most helpful. And sometimes the more metaphoric we've gotten, the better it's been for our customers. For example, we have this Sancerre that we described as classic, chic, timeless, like Catherine Deneuve. And that seemed to get people more, they seem to sort of understand what that wine was because it tastes like better than if we had used with notes of minerality and zesty citrus overtones.
Now, the one word that for me describes Sancerre, and to me it gets it, and it's interestingly because it's descriptive, and that's flinty.
Flinty, yes.
And which is not surprising since the soil in Sancerre is flinty.
Yes, yes.
But anyway, back to your some of your lists.
He does pairings, perfect pairings.
Yeah, but the one that you have that's missing, you probably know this. You probably just didn't put it up in your list. In blind tasting, there's no substitute for a sneak look at the cork. it's amazing how you can tell what hillside it was grown on.
We used to have fun with all those things.
Now, let me ask you to see into the future. I want to share with you what I really mean by taking a look at the past and the present, and possibly the worst wine bargain in your shop and any other one, which is Santa Margherita Pinot Grigio.
Santa Margherita, yes. Well, you put me on the spot. I mean, people love Santa Margherita Pinot Grigio. I just don't happen to be one of them.
No, you got two in this studio. Don't like it either.
And sort of given, as popular as it is, it's sort of given Pinot Grigio, which can be Pinot Gris, which it can be just a wonderful, wonderful wine,
a kind of
a bad name.
Yeah, I mean, by the time you have to be disappointed, and the good news is you will be, the bad news also is you will be.
Yeah. But
what I wanted you to do was look in your crystal ball, which is certainly less cloudy than mine, and say, you're not keen on Argentinian Malbec. I noticed that. You kind of think that's a little bit oversold. But what do you think is coming around the corner?
You know, it's hard to predict wine trends, but here are some things that I've noticed in the store. One is a renewed interest in Riesling, which had been for a long time kind of under the radar. Yes, that Riesling has now really been resurging.
Yeah, I've noticed that too.
whether it becomes a huge wave or not, I don't know. Is it the next Groiner Wertziner? I couldn't tell you. But I do notice that a lot more people are asking us about it, and I'm happy for that. I'm happy that they're discovering that the Riesling that they associated with kind of the 70s is really different, that the sort of stuff that was imported, at least at the low level, really has no connection with what nice Riesling is now.
Now, what you're looking for is something, I guess, we would categorize as bone dry, the opposite of Blue Nun and Cabernet.
Yeah, it's the opposite of Blue Nun. It actually, you know, it often has that balance of, there is so often some sweetness, but there's the sweetness that's and the acidity at the same time. And that's really what characterizes the Riesling that really pops and really makes you go, oh my goodness, now that's what all the fuss was about? Because otherwise, it's just sort of treacly and not as interesting.
What about among reds? A similar prediction among red wines?
Among red wines. We see in our store, and you know, it's that's admittedly a small sample, but a real trend towards lighter reds, not just the Pinot Noirs, but also, for example, Nebbiolo, which is the grape that you make Barolo out of, but often the Nebbiolos that are the declassified Barolo, so not quite Barolo, but lighter grapes, lighter reds.
And don't forget, pretty soon we'll all be buying English wines. Peter doesn't think that's too funny.
The interesting thing is that you, in the case of the red wine, you picked an Italian, and in the case of a white, you picked a German or a French or an Australian, for that matter.
Yeah,
some very fine Rieslings, especially the dry kind, coming from down under.
Yes.
What does California have to contribute? Anything, do you think, or just do they just need to bring their price down?
We're big fans of Northern California wines. Okay. Where they're not. Where I guess you get that sort of similar cooler coastal weather is in some ways similar to a European climate. And you get subtle wines, or it's not just something that's ham-fisted and super alcoholic, but wines with real finesse and character.
So they're almost Oregonian.
They're almost Oregonian, yes.
Which we like a lot.
We should not let our favorite hero of Oregon wine go by without mentioning his name, since we just did it off the air. That's Crazy Charles Smith.
Yeah.
He used to manage rock bands. Swore he was going to be out of the wine business, sold off his brands, and then started over again.
Well, they say it's the fastest way for a billionaire to become a millionaire.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. I thought the story in Napa was how much money does it take to make $2 million in Napa Valley? And the answer is start with five, and the answer might be 10. But there's a similar answer to the question: how can you be sure you'll be successful in the wine shop business? And the answer is, don't ever begin.
Where were you when I was starting up?
but if you want to find out a lot about what it's like unvarnished, then you have to read this book, Uncorked. I'm splitting time between Uncorked and Restaurant Man right now.
Yeah.
and sort of interweaving them in a wonderful way. The stories of Marco Passanella and Joe Bastianich are quite similar. And I bet you're good friends.
Yep. Well, I know Joe.
Yeah. Well.
maybe you're not good. I guess he doesn't have.
Let's just devote attention to the subtitle called "My Journey Through the Crazy World of Wine," because that's pretty much it.
Well, no, and it's a crazy journey, but it's been an amazingly satisfying one, and one that continues have us feel happy.
We thank you for contributing it. And I have a suggestion for you. I have a wonderful book about wine that if you haven't read, you ought to read, called Between the Vines. And you'll realize, when you read Between the Vines, you'll realize what I was talking about. That's all I'm going to say.
Thank you so much
for joining us. Viva Italia. Ciao, salute. Marco. Ciao and all that stuff.
And ciao to you guys and to all the listeners. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with another fascinating wine story right after this break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Talk about being eccentric. Here we have T.J. Evans.
No, Anne didn't make that up. Somebody else made that up and sent it to us.
Excellent, was it?
Excellent wines.
Yeah, but we, eccentric was my terminology.
Okay, then in that case you're brilliant.
But T.J. Evans conceived of making wine in concrete eggs.
Well, it's
so picture.
You're jumping to the end of the story rather than beginning at the beginning. You have to understand, and those of you who are into the wine business know that winemaking is a very traditional process. Change happens glacially, shall we say, and every now and then somebody steps out into the dark, and T.J. Evans from Domaine Canaris did that, and he came to talk to us all about that. The National Egg Marketing Board has a campaign that says, "What's for breakfast?" Maybe sparkling wine from the Canaris region of California isn't for breakfast. Maybe it is.
Why not?
But certainly the use of an egg-shaped container in the winemaking process reached us in time for Easter, but didn't reach us in time for put it into an Easter program. But anyway, it's now time to introduce T.J. Evans, who is the winemaker at Domaine Canaris, which is officially in the Sonoma region, T.J.?
Napa, I think you said.
Well, we're the Canaris AVA, but we're in the county of Napa, southern end of the Napa Valley.
Okay, great. And you've been making sparkling wines and Pinot Noirs there for couple of decades now. Remind me of exactly how long?
Well, Domaine Canaris was founded with the help of the Tatonge family in 1987, and we started with a tiny Pinot Noir program in 1992. So we've got a few years under our belt making premium wines from the Canaris region.
I have one of your wines. The name has a gate in it somewhere.
The Famous Gate was our first Pinot Noir, and it remains our flagship Pinot Noir to this day.
Yeah, I'm going to be tempted to open it for a special birthday that I have coming up this year, but it's really destined for another 10 years in the cellar, so we'll see how strong my principles are.
Well, that's nice to hear. You'll have to let me know how it tastes.
I'm sure it'll taste wonderful, but you made a bold decision just a few years ago. Can you go ahead and explain?
Sure, I would love to. 2008, I started playing around with trying to make a white wine from Pinot Noir, and it had been something that had been in the back of my head for quite a few years. But when I joined Domaine Canaris in 2008, it seemed like all the stars aligned, because it was really the right opportunity to do it. And the first reason is, as a sparkling wine house, we really like to night pick all of our grapes. We night pick the Pinot Noir and the Chardonnay, and we get them into the press early in the morning. And when you do that, when you press grapes that are cold, you have much lower chance getting color leaching out into the juice.
Every interview I'm on, I learn something. I never knew that.
You see,
about temperature.
You see, I've heard about night picking before, but the night picking I heard about was in climates where it was just too hot for people to pick during the day. So they do night picking in Sicily, and they do quite a lot of night picking in Australia because the ambient temperature during the day is so high.
Absolutely right. That's certainly a factor, too. Here in California, we're really blessed by that huge diurnal difference. So even though it'll get up to 80 or 90 during the day, it'll still be 40 to 50 at night. And so since we do pick everything by hand, it is much more comfortable to work during the night.
Now let's go back to the egg, because listeners are probably puzzling. Well, what's all this got to do with eggs? I mean, the one thing we know about eggs is you use egg whites in the fining process of making good wine. But that's not the reason. You became fascinated with two different things that caused you to get into the egg business.
Sure. Well, if I continue my story from 2008, I bought some barrels from a friend of mine named Jerome Aubin, and I was buying some Rousseau barrels, and Jerome is a Frenchman with a very international palate, so I teased him a little bit, and I said, "Jerome, I want you to try this wine," and I served him my white wine from Pinot Noir Blind, and I told him what it is. He looked at me, and he had a twinkle in his eye, and he said, "TJ, I've got something that you might be interested in." And what that turned out to be was a little concrete fermentation tank that formed in the shape of an egg.
Now, someone else had actually pioneered this before, right? I'm just looking at the background information you sent, and you're saying it was created by Michel Chapoutier?
I believe he had the initial idea. And okay. He was working with Marc Nombleau in the Northern Rhone Valley.
Okay.
And my friend Jerome was actually a distributor for Marc Nombleau, so he had the connection that we could import the tank France.
Now, you call it a tank, and automatically, I guess, when we think of tanks, we think of vessels that might be made out of a variety of things, including stainless steel, and your tanks up until then were stainless steel.
That's correct. It's funny because I call it a tank, but I could just as easily be calling it a large barrel. Because in reality, you know, a barrel only holds 60 gallons, and this concrete tank is 180 gallons. So if you're sitting at home and you're imagining a winery, you're probably imagining these towering stainless steel tanks with thousands and thousands of gallons. When in reality, this concrete tank is quite petite and has the equal volume of just three barrels.
But you actually had the massive stainless steel tanks before. That was core of your fermentation process, right?
Absolutely. A lot of the Chardonnays I do them in a barrel fermentation, but for all the sparkling wine, we use stainless steel tanks, and for the vast majority of the Pinot Noir, we use a Burgundian-style open-top tank that's of course made of stainless steel.
But anyway, back to the story then, back to the timeline. 2008, you found out about this. 2009, you got one?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first vintage that you used to ferment?
Yes. So the first step I did is I really wanted to understand how the concrete was contributing to the wine and how the flavors would change, so I did an experiment. And the way I did that is I took a few older, neutral oak barrels, and I have some small stainless steel barrels that are also 60 gallons, and of course I have my new egg. So I took the same juice, and I fermented in all three containers simultaneously.
Wow.
And then when did you start to notice the difference?
Well, immediately. It was partially what I expected and partially what I didn't expect. For me, the stainless steel it's very inert, it doesn't breathe, and the stainless steel made the wine brighter, fresher, and crisper, almost lean and angular. And then the oak barrel, if you imagine oak, the wood, compared to stainless steel, it's much more porous, it breathes. It kind of took the edge off the wine and made it a little bit rounder and a little bit juicier. And then the concrete had its own personality. There was almost a heightened sense of minerality to it. There were a little more notes of like golden hay. And so these differences are very subtle and they're very esoteric, but I loved the immediate results because I knew at the end of the day, when I was going to blend this wine together, each different vessel was going to contribute its own personality to the wine.
Okay, so you're actually doing that. You're actually mixing from each of the...
Blend those three different materials?
No, the three different kinds of juice, essentially.
You have
three different kinds of fermented juice, each of which has the character that he just described.
Yeah, no, that's what I meant. I just didn't...
Yeah, no, that's fine.
I didn't realize he did that. I thought it was all just with the egg.
No, we were laughing before we came on the air because I said an egg sounds a little bit like an amphora upside down.
You're quite right, Peter. That's exactly what it is. And that was part of the initial inspiration, as the story goes, that Michel Chapoutier wanted to use the egg because he was sort of reaching back and wanted to play around with some of the ideas that have lasted from antiquity. And it also almost bridges a philosophical gap to feng shui, because if you think about the shape of an egg or an orb, there are no corners to it. There are no dead spots. And the thought goes that the wine, because of temperature gradients and convection currents, it helps to keep the lees, the dead yeast, in suspension. And that is, it's almost like an auto mixer in a very, very slow state. And that helps to really develop the body and really add a new element of texture to the wine that's fermented in the egg.
Are you a biodynamic believer as well?
You know, my tastes don't run quite to biodynamic. I'm very proud of our organic farming history at Domaine Carneros. We've been certified as organic farmers since 2007.
That's good.
And we own 300 acres of vineyard. We grow 200 acres of Pinot and 100 acres of Chardonnay, and we farm it all organically. So we're very proud of our sustainable.
But you don't do the cow horn and manure thing.
We don't do the cow horn.
And you don't run naked through the fields in a full moon.
Well, I have been known to.
That's a different story altogether.
That's
a different story. Now, this is not your grandfather's concrete that you used to make sidewalks.
No, it's a very special concrete, Peter. In fact, it comes from very carefully selected and washed sand and gravel from the Loire River Valley.
Oh,
and
really?
And the way it's put together, there's actually no infrastructure to it. There's no steel reinforcement. There's no rebar. In fact, they build a wooden mold, and with the aid of ultrasonic mixers, they're able to pour a very dense type of concrete. So if you imagine an eggshell that's 3 inches thick of a very tight concrete.
Wow.
There's another element in the process as well, and that's the temperature in the fermentation process. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, with stainless steel, you obviously have the ability to control the temperature with refrigeration. The egg, however, just responds to the ambient temperature. So for me, when I get the juice into the egg, I need to get it at exactly the right temperature that I want. So if it's too cold, it'll go too slow, and if it's too hot, it'll go too quickly. I really have to get the temperature just right when we start the fermentation.
How do you do that?
By controlling it at the end of the press cycle. So like I said, it helps that we start with cold juice because we're starting with those cold night pick grapes.
Is there a difference in the length of time for fermentation to complete? I mean, you ferment and you ferment for a certain period of time so that you get the alcohol level to where you want it to be, as I understand winemaking. Now, is the fermentation period different for the barrels, the stainless steel, and the egg?
Yes. I mean, there's always a certain variable, but these are all they're all small-scale fermentations. They usually take about 10 days, and we ferment them to dryness because I do want the finished wine to be absolutely dry. So I'm not stopping it with any sugar left over.
Well, you're just doing an incredible job. I know because we have been at Domaine Canaris before, and we've drunk Domaine Canaris sparkling wines lots of times. Were you at all concerned in making this change that you might be making a change that wasn't good? Hell of a chancy business to say I'm going to do one-third of my wine or about that much from a totally different way of fermenting.
Well, we started much smaller than that.
Oh, okay.
You know, I started, I think in 2008 I made, I want to say, 160 cases of this wine. So it was really, compared to our overall production, it was equivalent to about a drop of wine. But I certainly had reservations going into 2008. I had really high hopes that we could make something that was innovative and exciting and successful. But I, in the back of my mind, I thought, wow, this is either great idea or my worst idea ever.
Right. Now, let's suppose that you're buying Domaine Canaris sparkling wines now, or you might buy them over the next few vintages. What's going to be the percentage mix, just roughly, of the egg wine that's going to be in there? Is it going to be 5% or 10% or 20%?
Well, the egg wine, the grapes and the juice that's fermented in the egg, it goes into one special wine, and we call that wine Pinot Clair, C-L-A-I-R, and we release that wine every year during the last Friday in January. And as I said, this is still a program. It's grown over the years. I'm up to about 325 cases per year. But I'm still having a hard time making enough wine to meet the demand. So for that reason, we only sell it to the visitors who come to the winery. But it's also available on our website.
Well, that's wonderful. So that deals with my next question. Where can you get some? And the answer is, you just gave it to us, the website, just so the listeners can have that, TJ?
Yes, absolutely, and I think...
No, let's speak it into the interview.
You can find us at Domaine Carneros, that's domainecarneros.com, all one word.
And listeners, TJ won't say this, so I'll say it for him. If you're anywhere near the Carneros vicinity, Domaine Carneros is just an absolutely grand place to go. It just happens to look like a French chateau. I'm not sure that that's something to do with the fact that the ownership of the property is French, but it's a splendid destination in and of its own right for a visit, and you can try all the wines, but of course you'll want to try the Pinot Clair, and you'll want to buy some to take home for sure. Now, what's next? You must be planning another adventure, surely.
Well, Peter, in fact, we are. We're looking at purchasing a new vineyard in the Carneros area that will enable us to plant some exciting new types of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, which will give us some more material to play with. As you know, I focus on the Pinot Noir, so I'm always interested in planting new grapes, working with new vineyards. So we have a lot of exciting things coming up here at the winery. Our range of sparkling wines is quite large now. We make 10 different sparkling wines that are all available at the winery as well, including a Blanc de Blanc, a Blanc de Noir, and our sparkling rosé has been so incredibly popular we can barely keep up with demand.
Yeah, it's become hot, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's a hit from Easter on through Mother's Day and graduation. It seems to be a real popular during springtime.
It's been in Europe for a lot longer than here, I know.
I think it's taken the American audience a little bit longer to catch on, because people who love champagne, they love pink sparkling wine, because you get all the nuttiness and toastiness and creaminess of a traditional brut, but you get the fruit character from Pinot Noir layered on top. And once you taste that, made in a beautiful, pure style, it's really something special.
Well, listeners, by the time you hear this, it's going to be way past Mother's Day, but I can tell you what we're drinking in this house on Mother's Day. It's going to be Domaine Carneros Sparkling Rosé. And thank
Fantastic.
You, TJ, thank you for making it for us, and thank you so much for joining us today on the menu.
Well, Peter and Ann, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Great.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And if you think that's interesting, wait and listen to the track that's coming right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and this story starts in Pennsylvania in 1753. Is that sufficiently intriguing? You think people will listen to the story of Michters and the story of
It's a great story.
Vodka and gin, all conceived by Joe Malioko, whose name I mispronounce all the time, but nevertheless, we're pleased to bring you this fascinating story. Peter just got a lecture from Anne and said you have to pronounce this man's name correctly. It's Malioko. Joe Malioko likes swimming against the tide. He likes trying to paddle upstream. So in the 1990s, when everybody said brown spirits are dead, brown spirits, just in case you're wondering, a bourbon, rye, and things like that, and everybody said they were dead, and he said, no, they're not, and we're going to put our future into brown spirits. Not only that, but the major brands, historical families like Jim Beam and the people who make Maker's Mark, were all selling out to big companies and then pretending that they still ran their distilleries like they did in the past. You decided to do something entirely opposite. You said, we're going to make the best bourbon and rye whiskey, regardless of cost. You must be crazy.
That's what a lot of people said in the 90s. Probably still do when they know me. But first of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. I am a big fan, and I've spent quite a bit of time listening to your archives, which are really remarkable.
Okay.
But yeah, in the 1990s, you know, I'd been working in the wine and spirit business for years, and a good friend of mine was working with me. He's a gentleman, Dick Newman. He actually won a Purple Heart in the Korean War. He's a war hero who lost his arm in the war. Dick had been president of Austin Nichols, the maker of Wild Turkey. And Dick, like me, had seen what you refer to as brown goods and whiskey basically in a bad decline sales-wise through the 1980s and the 1970s and the 1990s, the beginning of the 1990s. We thought it was just so quintessentially American and that whiskey was so good that at some point there was a good chance it would come back. And so we thought it was actually a good business proposition to try to make really good whiskey again. And Dick said we should really look for something that has some history to it. And I immediately thought of Michters. When I was in college, I actually worked as a summer job, and part of my summer job was actually selling Michters.
Oh,
yeah. And in 1978, the summer of 1978, so quite a long time ago. And when I mentioned Michters, he said that's the right brand to try to acquire. And so we decided to resurrect the brand. Michters was actually founded in 1753, traces back to America's first whiskey company, has a lot of history. General George Washington actually stopped there on his way to Valley Forge to get liquor for the troops. We always say, and they won. We've been trying to make really, really, really good whiskey, basically regardless of what it costs to make. I mean, if there's something that we know how to do, my partners have said, don't worry about the expense, just make the best whiskey you possibly can.
Hold on just a second, Joe.
Sure.
Because it wasn't just as simple as you described it, because Michters was actually shut down, right? Michters was in bankruptcy and shut down. How did you figure out how to make it? I mean, did they have the recipe locked away somewhere like they do for Coca-Cola?
Well, there's a lot of conjecture about the old Michters recipes, and I'm repeatedly lectured by my master, Willie Pratt, to get into certain things about mash bills and this and that. But basically, you know, Dick having run Austin Nichols, and before that, having worked at National Distillers. At National Distillers, which is a big company, he ran Old Granddad, Old Crow, and Old Taylor.
He knew a little bit about the formula for making good bourbon.
Exactly. And rye. Because rye used to be a very big spirit. And rye is quite interesting because before Prohibition, rye had a much bigger market share among American brown spirits. And when I mention rye, I mean real American rye. Some people sort of refer to, after a while, start to refer to sort of any brown whiskey other than bourbon as rye. But real American rye whiskey actually has a government definition. It has to be fermented from a mash bill of at least 51% true rye grain.
Yeah.
And so that's partly what gives it that great spicy taste of good rye and gives it that extra character.
But you couldn't get it. I mean, I remember it's sort of closer to my mother's generation because we had friends of that vintage come to visit us, and this is Elizabeth Ann, drank rye and something.
They drank Four Roses.
And we gave them Four Roses because any rye.
That's what they drank.
But we didn't have the old stuff.
Well, Four Roses is rye. That's what they drank.
Four Roses makes great whiskey, and I'm not sure about the particular Four Roses that they were drinking then. I know it's gone through different iterations from its ownership by Seagram's and ownership by other people. But real American rye is just terrific and makes terrific cocktails. And it's interesting. The market share for rye was much bigger before Prohibition. After Prohibition, the big distillers really concentrated on bourbon. And a lot of people in the industry think that they concentrate on bourbon partly because corn, which bourbon is primarily made from, corn is less expensive than rye grain, and also because rye grain is much harder to work with at the distillery. The fermenting tanks foam up, the rye grain sticks on the sides. It's just a lot more involved trying to make a good rye versus trying to make a good bourbon, although I love both.
Now, you actually moved Michter's, though. Having acquired the Michter's name, you moved it to Kentucky because you said... That's where it's all made these days, and you had good reasons why, because you're surrounded by people who know a lot about making whiskey.
Yeah, Dick Newman obviously knew a lot from all his work at National Distillers and Wild Turkey. He knew an awful lot about Kentucky. And he said to me, look, for American whiskey, Kentucky is like Napa is for American wine. If you really want to make the best, you have to try to be with the best. And it's interesting. The resources in Kentucky are just tremendous. We're constantly trying to figure out ways to make our product even better. We're always trying to improve on things. And if you walk 3 feet in Kentucky, you'll bump into the world's expert on the whiskey filtration. Working with some of these people, some are old timers, some are young people that are very bright. Working with these type of people, we'll conduct experiments. We will filter the same different whiskey over 30 different ways, just so we can compare them and just see what's the absolute best style of filtration for this particular whiskey, and we've really come up with a very signature filtration that we use.
In one case, though, in the activities that you have under this Chatham Imports company that you and Dick own, you did catch on to one trend. You latched onto that one, which is the increasing popularity of white spirits.
Correct.
Organic.
So you have an entry in both gin and vodka. How did that come about?
It came about because there are a lot of people on our team at Michter's and our team at Chatham. There's a lot of people here that, we have a wine business that's a great business, but we're really, really passionate as a team, and we're really excited about spirits, and we love to make interesting, really high-quality spirits. And we saw the organic food business growing tremendously. And aside from it growing tremendously, we also, saw and had read a lot about sustainability, and this is, over 10 years ago, and basically how making organic products is actually better for the environment. Forget arguably whether they taste better and are healthier or not, but it's actually better for the environment. For example, when we make organic spirits, the grain that we use to ferment, it has to be grown, it has to be on land that has been for 3 years, had no chemical fertilizers for 3 years, no chemical pesticides. It can't be irradiated grain, and a lot of what we eat now is irradiated food. It can't be genetically modified, and a lot of the food that we're eating today is genetically modified. And without this irradiation and all these chemicals, when you produce stuff, it's actually better for the environment as well. And the other thing was that always experiment, we've experimented with hundreds of different things that we never come out with because we like to try try different stuff. We actually felt that our organic vodka, we make a USDA-certified organic vodka called Crop Organic Vodka.
Which is wonderful. It's clean, but it has life to it.
You're very kind. Well, we call it the world's cleanest vodka. It has, as you said, it has a life to it, and we actually thought that the organic spirit tastes better, and we thought it actually makes a cleaner base also, too, for adding flavors. And when we went into the flavor business, rather than come out with the 4 millionth citrus vodka or the 4 millionth vanilla vodka, you know, we decided to try different vegetable flavors. And we tried a lot of different vegetable flavors. And one vegetable flavor that we tried making a vodka with an infusion of organic-compliant cucumbers. And it was delicious. And our crop organic cucumber vodka is selling quite well. And our 80-proof crop artisanal vodka is selling quite well. And what's interesting is it's not just here. I have a son who lives in China, and we recently, about 6 months ago, we opened up Hong Kong, and we're starting to open up more of China on both Michter's, which is doing great in China, and on the Crop Organic Vodka. And it's interesting internationally how interested people are in organic spirits. I think the organic certification means a lot to the people there, and it's really been helping us a lot.
Now, Joe, what's the grain or potato or whatever it is that you use behind the crop vodka?
That one I can tell you. The mash bill is 100% USDA organic corn. And again, we source it from these four farms. And it's interesting, too, because like really good organic farmers, they actually have a buffer zone around the perimeter of their property. And they only, even though they farm it organically in that buffer zone, they don't sell it as organic corn.
It's only really
from the heart of these big farms, you know, where there's not danger of cross-pollination, that we get our corn that we use for our organic spirit.
Now, what about gin?
The gin, we make a USDA organic gin called Farmer's Gin, which is doing quite well for us. And obviously, any good gin, by definition, has to have juniper. And Farmer's Gin is organic. We use the same mash bill that we use as a base of our organic crop vodkas. But we add organic juniper, and we tried a whole bunch of different variations of botanicals. But we found that when we added organic elderflower in combination with organic lemongrass,
that was
a really interesting, really good combination. So we have juniper, but there's good juniper in there, but it's not something that just sort of a one-note hit you over the head juniper gin. It also has some other wonderful tastes that come through terrifically in cocktails.
Well, this is a trend, I think, actually, in gin production.
Yeah, do you know the guys from Cold River in Maine?
I do not know them personally. I'm a fan of their products.
Yeah,
they're good products.
Too.
They make their gin is potato-based.
Right. Right, yeah, potatoes are a great thing to ferment with. Potato-based vodka can be terrific as well.
Now, the fascinating news on the horizon you told us just before we were coming onto the program, because I think you mentioned that, in fact, you're using someone else to do the distillation of your products today in the region of the country where the corn is grown, but pretty soon you're going to take that over yourselves, and that will give you more control?
Yeah, that will give us more control. You know, we've had our own whiskey program in Kentucky for years, but in Minnesota, we've actually been going to another distillery and working with them, very good people, and distilling there. Really, our expansion in production is really a function of Michter's growing. I mean, Michter's is a small brand. We're probably always going to be a small brand. Fortunately, we've gotten some people that like us. I mean, Food and Wine magazine said that our 10-year-old bourbon was the best American whiskey. The Wall Street Journal recently said that our rye is phenomenal. That's their word. I like that word for Michter's. And we also got the highest rating that wine enthusiast has ever given a whiskey for Michter's. So while we're concentrating on trying to produce the best whiskey that we possibly know how. And we have to allocate our production right now because we just don't have nearly enough to sell compared to what the orders we get, and gradually expanding our production. We bought the historic Fort Nelson building on Museum Row in downtown Louisville. It's opposite the Louisville Slugger, the Bat Plant and Museum, which is a wonderful tourist attraction if anybody's ever down there. And Louisville's a terrific city with terrific people, and we're rebuilding this 1890 vintage building. You can actually Google the Fort Nelson building and see this wonderful building. It looks like a little castle. And hopefully we're also going to close on a second facility in the next couple of days to expand our distillation capacity. So we're really, really quite excited.
It's an all-American success story. The only thing that puzzles me is how it's Mr. Malioko who's been doing it.
I know.
You, at the very least, you ought to be called Daniels or Beam or something like that.
Exactly, but I didn't get to pick my name out.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Joe, it's been a pleasure today.
Yeah, it's just been a delight. The only sad thing is you said it's on allocation, so we're not going to be able to get any more. We drank it all.
I have to hold some back for the dining divas, so I wouldn't worry about it in your case.
Thank you.
Well, it's a fascinating story. We wish you the continued success that you deserve for being prepared to be pioneers.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it, Joe.
And we'll be back with a fascinating surprise story right after the break. So don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I guess we're a little bit late for all the hoopla surrounding what would have been Julie Child's 100th birthday, but we did our bit.
Not to be outdone.
Of course, at the time, there were books and programs about every aspect of Julie's life. In particular, I got not one but two books about Julie and her cats. Well, I covered the pretty one, the children's book, although we don't usually do children's books. It's really a lovely, lovely picture, and our grandchildren love it.
So you're going to love it too.
when our guest called in just a moment ago, I said, "Pussycat, Pussycat, where have you been?" And she didn't know the answer. Which means that she hasn't been researching cats perhaps as much as she claims, having produced a wonderful book called Minette's Feast. But Minette's Feast is more than just a book about a cat, isn't it?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's all there in the subtitle, The Delicious Story of Julia Child and Her Cat.
Exactly.
So it's about a cat and Julia Child and cooking.
Yes.
And about the cat eating Julia Child's cooking, I think, is perhaps even more apropos.
Yes, and what's really fun is that it's all a true story, that Julia Child was a cat lover, and she got her first cat when she moved to Paris. And this cat, Minette, lived with her during the years that she was a student at the Cordon Bleu and was learning to cook. So the cat got to eat all her leftovers every time she was practicing and experimenting. But at the same time, there were mice in the apartment. And so Julia would give Minette leftover Boeuf Bourguignon or Coq au Vin or something fabulous. And Minette, in turn, would occasionally leave Julia a dead mouse on the living room rug.
Oh, so that's really true. And the other thing you did that was interesting is you actually extracted all the dialogue from other sources.
That's right. I found out about Minette reading Julia Child's memoir, My Life in France. And then I read other biographies of her, such as Noel Riley Fitch's Appetite for Life and Laura Shapiro's biography. And any time there were quotes from letters or a quote from the memoir about Minette and about Julia and her husband Paul's life in Paris, I would kind of weave those into the text.
Now, you, Susanna Reich, are the author, and the illustrations are also so notable. Amy Bates, they're just absolutely charming.
Well, thank you.
I just have to keep staring at particularly this drawing of the illustration of the cat, and with her full name, Minette Mimosa McWilliams Child.
Yes. Well, McWilliams was Julia Child's maiden name.
Right.
Okay. And the mimosa part came from an incident where Julia had brought home some mimosa flowers that she had picked, and the cat started to eat them.
Oh, my.
So they decided to make that part of her name.
Well, I have two questions here, Susanna. Number one, I actually did not know it was a children's book. I didn't read my press release carefully until it arrived, which, because we don't do a lot of children's books. But we do, of course, food books, and Julie Child is always of interest. What age is this book aimed for, and what is your mission in writing it?
Well, I'd say it's aimed for children between the ages of about 3 and 8. And my mission in writing it was to introduce children who might not have heard of Julia Child before to our beloved chef. You know, I grew up watching Julia Child on TV, and I got to meet her when I used, before I was an author, I was a floral designer, and I actually designed the flower arrangements for her 80th birthday party in New York. And which was 20 years ago, because we're coming up to the 100th anniversary of her.
So there's that to know, too, yes.
Yes, and I've wanted to write a book about her ever since. So when I finally read her memoir and found out that she loved cats, I thought that was a great way to introduce Julia to children. Because children, they eat peanut butter and jelly and spaghetti and meatballs, and they're not so interested in gourmet food usually. Mm-hmm. So I didn't think just a straight biography would appeal to young children. But when I found out about the cat and the mice and eating the leftovers, then I thought, well, there's a way to tell a story that's really charming and shows a different side of Julia, too.
Well, you see, I disagree. I think that this is a book for children from age of 3 to 83. I really think it's such a charming book. It reminds me a little bit of a poem that my mother found one day, and that she sort of said, "Well, I'm going to adopt this a little bit in my life." And somewhere in the poem it says, "When I'm old, I will wear purple."
In other words,
when I'm old, I will do as I please, which includes reading books called Minette's Feast.
Oh yes,
which is intended for an 8-year-old.
Yes, well, you're right. We should all enjoy reading picture books, and it's a pleasure that many adults have forsaken. And part of the fun of reading to your children is you get to enjoy the books that they're enjoying.
Yeah, well, we do this with our grandchildren, and this book, Minette's Feast, is heading towards South Carolina very shortly. and I will enjoy reading it to the grandchildren.
Yeah, it's going to be one of the more interesting ones that we have. And we might actually not cry. One of our other favorites was called, what was it called, Shel Silverstein's book?
Oh, the Giving Tree.
The Giving Tree.
Oh, yes.
Which do you know this book?
Yes, I do.
I guarantee that every time you read it, you get tears in your eyes.
We cried and cried now.
We cried and cried
like it.
at the same place all the time.
Uh-huh.
And the poor rotten old man can do nothing but sit on what's left of the tree.
Susanna, when do the awards come out for children's books? I bet this is going to be one.
Oh, well, the American Library Association gives out the major awards for children's books in January. So they wait till the year is over and all the books for that year have been published. So this coming January, they'll be giving out awards.
Well, we'll be surprised if you don't get one. In the meantime, as we were discussing before you joined us, before we started this interview on the program, congratulations on even getting a children's book published.
Thank you.
That's really difficult. I opine that if you were Prince Charles, Prince of Wales, and Duke of Cornwall, you had a chance. Otherwise, you were really struggling. So you've done very well, and it's really a delightful project. I'm looking forward to reading it to our grandchildren as well. It'd be better than, what's the other one there? The Nutcracker?
Oh, yes.
I hate the Nutcracker.
Yeah, that's long, too.
and it's long, and it has these ugly rats in it. No, don't like that one at all. And Cinderella's not much either. So we'll do Minette's Feast with a lot of pleasure, and we thank you so much for bringing this pleasure into our lives and to so many other people's as well.
Thank you very much.
And good luck with the book, Susanna.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
You too.
And there you have it.
We'll you may not think that would fit into a booze program, but Julia did like her wine.
She did.
And I wouldn't put it past her that she probably offered Minette a saucer full of wine instead of milk.
Nothing she would do would surprise me.
Right.
Julia, wherever you are watching, we hope you and your cat are enjoying your time And that you listeners will join us again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.